We come this week to examine the 21st chapter of the Gospel of Luke. This is a chapter that we have looked at in part before, in several different ways. We have here things that seem to be not connected, but there is a link. We begin at the start of the chapter with Jesus still in the temple. Notice again, chapter and verse division is not inspired. Jesus looked up and saw. Now this follows on from the previous chapter. This is continuous. This is happening at the same time. Jesus has said at the end of the previous chapter, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplaces, on the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honour at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." And then he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box. And he saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. So Jesus has just given a warning about the scribes. He said, beware of these people. These people are hypocrites. These people do things for outward show. They do it in order to get the acclaim, the praise of men. They don't do it because they're godly. They do it because they're wicked and corrupt. And they are doing it to gain favour. And then he looks up and he says, right, now we have the object lesson. Notice, here are two, well, there's one group of people and one person. The one person is a widow. She is poor. She has almost nothing. All she has, we are told, are two small copper coins. And she puts in all that she has, two small copper coins. And most people standing around and observing this would have said, why does she bother? That's insignificant. Complete waste of time. Whereas the rich who are standing there, look how much they are putting in. They are putting in vast sums. They are putting in 10 times as much money as this woman earns in a week. Sorry, in a year. So what they're doing is of far greater importance, far greater significance. So therefore, these are more moral, these are more noble, these are more righteous, these are more holy, these are far more godly people than this woman. And Jesus says, rubbish. Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For they all contributed out of their abundance. But she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. So if you were to examine not the amount of money that was put in, but the proportion of their wealth that they put in, the rich might well have put in 10% of their wealth. The widow put in 100% of her wealth. Who is giving in a more sacrificial, godly, holy, and righteous a manner? Quite clearly, it's the woman. And if you have forgotten, the reason why we don't have a collection and we have the boxes at the back is so that you can put in whatever you choose without criticism of someone sitting next to you, and when they see that you can only afford to put in 10 pence, to say, well, that's not a lot, I put in far more than that. People can't do that. You can do it secretly, you can do it in private, so people don't know. And they don't think well or bad of you on the basis of how much money you're contributing. If you sat next to me in any meeting where there was an offering plate came round, you would think I was extremely stingy, because on principle I will not put money into an open plate. because of that very reason. But then people would look at this and say, well, there's no connection between this little incident, these few verses at the beginning of the chapter, and the rest of the chapter. Because the rest of the chapter is talking about the time of the end. So what's the connection? Well, you just have to read verse 5. And while some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, look at this magnificent building, they were saying. See how gorgeous it is. See how splendid, how spectacular this building is. All these precious stones, gold and such like. Herod the Great, that is Herod the murderer, Herod the one who slaughtered the children under 2 years old when the wise men came to him, that Herod had spent an awful lot of money in beautifying the temple. If you read back in the accounts, Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, about the rebuilding of the temple. The temple was first erected under King Solomon. That temple was a glorious temple, but it was destroyed by the Babylonians. And it was rebuilt when the Jews returned from exile in Babylon. But the people who had seen the original wept when they saw the new one, when they realized that it was going to be nothing like as splendid as the original. Well, Herod, not himself being a Jew, he was an Idumean, that's from across the Jordan, and he had his position thanks to the Romans. He thought he would ingratiate himself with the Jews and make them think well of him, instead of thinking, oh, this foreigner ruling over us, by building and extending the temple and making it a glorious, beautiful, magnificent temple. It took decades of work to get it to the state it was in at the time that Jesus was speaking. So they're talking about this magnificent building. And we look around at the chapel and various people say, what a wonderful building this is. But this is tiny compared to how big the temple was. The temple was magnificent. And there were some there with him who would talk about how magnificent it was. And he has to prick the bubble. He said, as for these things that you see, the days will come when there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. Now this would have come as an enormous shock to his hearers. Jesus wasn't now talking about the temple of his body. He was talking about these piles of brick, these piles of stone. This is what's going to happen to them. They're going to be destroyed. They're going to be overturned. Not one left standing upon another. And so, not surprisingly, they ask the question, teacher, when will these things be? What will be the sign when these things are about to take place? Do they think, well, how long is this going to last? This building's been here for hundreds of years. So when is this going to happen? So they ask the question, when it's going to happen, and how they will know it's about to happen. Now here we immediately step upon a problem, because most of the books that are published on this chapter will tell you that most of this chapter, if not all of this chapter, is dealing with what will happen before Jesus returns. So this chapter is still in the future. It is still yet to happen. That's what the majority of the books will tell you. They will go into great details. They will talk about a 10-nation confederacy, based on words in Daniel and Revelation. And this 10-nation confederacy will be a revived Roman Empire. And in the 1970s, when I read a lot of books about this and believed what these books said, they were all saying that revived Roman Empire is the common market, which was only then just starting to transmogrify into the European Economic Community. then into the European Community, and now into the European Union, and we wonder how long before it becomes the nation of Europe. There are various people in this country who are certain they will make sure that does not happen. This is not a party political broadcast, by the way. And when there were 9 member states, these books were saying, there's only got to be one more. And in 1976, when there was a referendum as to whether we stayed in or not, people forget that, we were already in. Some people think that's when we chose to go in. No, we didn't. It was Edward Heath who chose to go in. 1973 was when we joined. They would say, well, Britain might leave, but it doesn't matter. Because if Britain leaves, there will be 2 more. At the moment, 1 more, they were saying, but there will be 2 more. But then we had more than 1 more join, and now it's 25. And I wonder what's happened to all those books that so confidently predicted that the European Union would be 10 nations. You'll probably find what they're saying now is, well, of course, Ireland's really part of Britain, and that Portugal's really part of Spain, and that you can merge a lot of the other countries. So, really, there will be 10. Well, this is really clutching at straws for no purpose, because what the Bible says doesn't give us any problems like that. If we read what the passage itself says, the problems disappear. What is the question being asked? What is the answer? What question is being answered? And the question being asked is, when will the temple be destroyed? Here is the temple now. When is the temple going to be destroyed? So Jesus tells us. He says there are these signs to look for. These are the things that will happen. And he says towards the end, verse 29, and he told them a parable, look at the fig tree and all the trees as soon as they come out in leaf. You see for yourselves and know that the summer is already near. So also, when you see these things take place, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly I say to you, this generation, you lot, the people who are alive now as I speak, this generation, not some future generation, the generation he is speaking to, will not pass away until all this has taken place. Now, a biblical generation is usually reckoned to be about 40 years. Jesus is talking roughly in AD 33, so that would take us at a maximum to AD 73. Is there anything within that time frame that fits what's described here? And the answer is yes. Jerusalem, the Jewish war began in AD 66, and Jerusalem was captured by the Romans in AD 70. And the Jews fought like tigers to prevent the Romans gaining access to the temple, particularly the Holy of Holies. And the Romans thought there must be some great treasure contained here. And they were amazed when there was nothing. They couldn't understand it. So they thought, well, the treasure must be hidden somewhere within the building. And so they tore the building to pieces. They turned over all the stones so that not one stone was left standing upon another, because they were looking for treasure. And they failed to find it. There were wars, there were tumults, there were rumours of wars, there were earthquakes, there were famines, there were pestilences. And the worst tribulation that the world has ever known took place during those years. So bad were the conditions that mothers were cooking their own babies. Such was the shortage of food. Some people were trying to escape, would run out to give themselves up to the Romans, but the Romans heard this rumour that the Jews were rich and they had swallowed their jewels. and so everyone who tried to escape was sliced open. The Romans ran out of wood to make crosses with for the number of people they crucified. There were people within Jerusalem saying, "I am the Messiah, follow me and we will overcome the Romans." It's exactly what Jesus said here. And Jesus gives direct counsel to them. This isn't counsel given to people living in the future, this is counsel given to them. Verse 12, "But before all this they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake, as they were. This will be your opportunity to bear witness. Settle it before in your minds, not to meditate beforehand how to answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict." Notice the context of this. Jesus is not saying, if you're a preacher, don't bother preparing what you're going to say. There are some people who will quote this passage and say, "Well, I don't need to prepare my sermons, I just stand up and I preach whatever God tells me to." And unfortunately, God doesn't tell them anything. So either they stand there and say nothing, or they come out with a load of drivel. You can often tell someone who is unprepared because what they say is totally disjointed, doesn't really make sense, doesn't hang together, and usually goes on far too long. Well, I have to add that when my aunt, as I mentioned this last week, when my aunt used to say to me, complain about the length of my sermons, and say, "My vicar used to say, if you can't say it in 5 minutes, it's not worth saying," to which I replied, "If you can say it in 5 minutes, you've got nothing to say. There's nothing worth saying." Now, what Jesus is saying here is, when you, the apostles, and any other believers with them, when you suffer persecution, when you are put before the authorities, I will give you the words to say. That's not a promise to everybody, it's a promise to those to whom it was spoken. Always be careful and look at the context, and the context includes the person speaking and the person being spoken to. You get in John 16 a similar instance where people will often quote it, and they will, in their prayers and Bible studies, they will say, "Lord, you promised to lead us into all truth." Well, if that's true, how come Christians disagree? How come one group believes this and another group believes that? How come one group believes one thing and one group believes another thing? But they'll both say God leads us into all truth. Well, who's wrong? Well, they're both wrong, because that's not what Jesus said. He said, you, 11 people sitting round this table, remember Judas had left, you 11 people sitting round this table, to you I am saying, I will guide you, sorry, the Spirit will guide you into all truth. And that is exactly what the Spirit did in giving us the New Testament. The promise was made to them. It was not made to us. Always consider who is being spoken to. So what we have here is not a prediction as to what's going to happen in the future. As far as we're concerned, it's a prediction of what would happen in the future as far as Jesus and his hearers were concerned. This is what was going to happen at 70 AD. And when people say, "But we haven't seen any of these things," verse 25, "There will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and on the earth, distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, etc. The problem so often is that people don't read the Bible. They read bits of the Bible. Much of what is said here uses what is called apocalyptic language. And if you go back into the Old Testament, you find just the same language. You have the parallel passage to this is Matthew 24. when Jesus talks about the stars falling from heaven. And people say, that's not happened yet, so therefore this must be future. To which I say, read the Old Testament, the three instances in the Old Testament where exactly the same language is used. And what you find is, it is used concerning the fall, the downfall, of great nations or cities. Egypt falls, a great fall. And it's as if the stars fell from heaven. This is picture language, it's not literal language. And surprise, surprise, Jesus uses the same language as you find in the Old Testament. If you're going to understand the New Testament, you've got to read the Old. I was talking to someone on the phone the other day. Had an opportunity to preach the gospel to her. And she said, but I go to church. And she was saying, but the Old Testament, that's not relevant, is it? I don't need to read the Old Testament. I said, if you want to understand the New Testament, you've got to read the Old. Because the New Testament uses Old Testament language and pictures. And you're not going to understand that unless you know the Old Testament. So this whole chapter, or the major portion of this chapter, is talking about what was to come in 70 AD. And it did. And so Jesus' words were fulfilled. But that's not the main thing I wanted us to look at this morning. The main thing I wanted us to consider this morning was this woman and her small amount of money and how much she gave compared to the others. What we find is that in the Old Testament, under the law, people were obliged to give one-tenth of their income. It was given to support the Levites. And tithing was linked with temporal blessings. That is, if you gave, you received back. You'll find this in Malachi chapter 3. So it's the last book of the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 8. Will man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you? In your tithes and contributions. You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the full tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open the windows of heaven for you, and pour down for you a blessing, until there is no more need. So tithing was linked to temporal blessings. Again, notice the context. Who was being spoken to? God was speaking to those people then. We have to be careful in saying that this promise of blessing continues into the future. It's dangerous to say that. Otherwise you will end up believing the health, wealth and prosperity gospel, which says that God wants us all to be healthy and wealthy and to prosper in this world. And yet when you read Fox's Book of Martyrs, you think, but how can these people be real Christians when they suffered greatly, when they had all their wealth taken away, when they were severely persecuted and some were put to death? Clearly they couldn't have been Christians, because we know, the Bible tells us, and I'll quote a verse like that, health, wealth and prosperity. There is a book that was written based on this theme by a woman whom I won't name, but she lives in Oswestry Street, and the book was entitled Let the Healing Flow, in which she's putting forward this idea that Christians should never, ever, under any circumstances, be ill unless they've sinned. Now here is someone who has not read the whole Bible quite clearly, or if she has, it's very superficial, because it's clear that's not the teaching of the Bible. It is clear that people suffer for other reasons than for sin. Jesus himself makes this clear in John chapter 9, when the disciples say to him, Lord, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he should be born blind? And Jesus said, no, there is another reason of which you are completely oblivious. It's that the power of God may be shown in this man's life. This man was born blind in order that one day he would meet me and I could heal him and you could see the power of God at work. That's why he was born blind. It's not because of his sin, not because of his parents' sin. It's in order that he might be used by God to prove who God's Son is. You read the book of Job, and in the book of Job you discover that sin is not suffering is not necessarily caused by sin. There are other reasons that are often beyond our understanding. Our understanding is feeble. So do not draw a connection between the amount of money you give, even as a percentage, and what blessing you receive materially. Because usually they say, you give lots of money to God, and God is no man's debtor. So if you give lots of money to God, God will give you lots back. So it's better than the lottery, because with the lottery, it's a 14 million to one chance of winning the jackpot. But if you give to God, God will give you back. So it's 1 to 1. Not 14 million to 1. Not the teaching of the Bible. Some people will say that tithing is an eternal principle that you find right from the time of Abraham onwards. Unfortunately, they often don't read about Abraham, because if you actually read what it says, you discover that Abraham did not give a tithe of his wealth. In Genesis chapter 14 and verse 20, what we read is this, that he meets with Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed him and said, this is verse 19, "Bless thee, Abraham, by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Remember, Abraham, as he was then, Abraham as he was to become, had been and fought a battle with a group of kings who had sacked Sodom and taken away all the possessions of Sodom. Abraham went after them, defeated them, and was bringing back the booty. Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abraham, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." But Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted my hand to the Lord Most High, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap of anything that is yours, lest anyone should say, I have made Abraham rich." He's talking about the booty. He's talking about what had been stolen. And he gave to Melchizedek a tenth of everything of the booty. This wasn't Abraham's property that he was giving a tenth of. You find also that Jacob, at the time of Jacob's ladder, says, "You bring me safely home and I will give you a tenth of everything." There's no compulsion. This is entirely voluntary. But when we get into the law makes it compulsory. And that's what the Pharisees did. They said, it's got to be a tenth. So they would make sure they gave a tenth of everything, of mint, of dill, of cumin. They were even concerned about their herbs. Now, Jesus didn't condemn them for doing that. He condemned them for overemphasizing that. That was the be-all and end-all. And the other things, righteousness, mercy, etc., well, they were irrelevant. As long as you gave your tenth of everything, you were okay. But when you come into the New Testament, you're breathing different air because the old covenant has come to an end. Hebrews makes this very clear at the end of Hebrews 8, verse 13. And that which is obsolete is ready to pass away, which it did in AD 70. The temple gone, the sacrificial system gone, we are now fully under the new covenant. And under the new covenant, no Christian is ever commanded, you must give a tenth. The whole basis for giving in the New Testament is different from the Old. And you find it, we won't read it all for the sake of time, but when you get home, if you take the Bibles out and read 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Let's just pick out the highlights. Verse 5 of 2 Corinthians 8. Talking about the Macedonians. they gave themselves first to the Lord and then by the will of God to us. So their giving came out of the fact they had given themselves to God, which immediately reminds us of the wrong-headed thinking of the Pharisees and many people today. R.T. Kendall wrote a book entitled Tithing. He was very hot on tithing. He said one of the problems in the British church was that people didn't tithe, and that as a consequence, pastors suffered greatly because they lived on a pittance. They had to buy their clothes from charity shops. They had to go to scrapyards to get components for their aged cars to be repaired. And it was a disgrace. Well, I agree with him. All of that is a disgrace. But tithing's not the solution. And at the beginning of the book, he says he learned about tithing when he was young. He got his first job delivering newspapers. And at the end of his first week's work, he was paid his wages and he brought them home and he put them on the table. He said, "Look, Mum and Dad, my first week's wages that I've ever earned. And it's all mine." Well, I forget exactly what the sum was. You'll have to read the book. Actually, I wouldn't recommend reading the book, but you can look in the book to find what it was. But his father reached the cross and he took a coin, and it was a tenth. And his father said, "No, son, that's yours. This is God's." That's entirely wrong. That is not the teaching of the Bible. The teaching of the Bible is, "No, son, you're wrong. That's not yours. All of that is God's. God has loaned it to you, and you are to steward it. You are to make good use of it. So all of it is God's. So therefore you must be wise in how you use it. And some of it you should use for the support of others, for believers, for the support of the ministry, etc., etc., etc." But this is the danger of teaching tithing. It gets people to think, right, I've given my tenth, all the rest is mine, I can do what I like with it. That's wrong. It's all God's, and you've given some of God's to the work of God. Now, if you first give yourself to God, then you will think, well, I belong to God, so everything I am belongs to God, and everything I own belongs to God, and it is all to be used for God. But people have this mentality, no, one tenth is for God, and well, this tenth goes off into this little corner, and that's God's work. But what I do the rest of the time, that's me and mine. It's entirely wrong. We belong to God. God owns us. And we have to live in the light of that. But also, chapter 9 and verse 15, at the end of the chapter, Paul reminds them, "Thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift." When we think of what God has done for us, then how much should we respond in what we do and what we give? So it flows out of conversion. It flows out of what God has done. It's not commanded. It's the response of a thankful, grateful, loving heart. Verse 8 of chapter 8. "I say this not as a command, but to prove the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine." It's not legalistic, it's cheerful. Chapter 9, verse 7, "God loves a cheerful giver, not reluctantly or under compulsion. We're to give according to our means, and the Macedonians gave beyond their means." This is the theme all the way through these two chapters. We are to give cheerfully, we are to give sacrificially. And it does talk here about reaping what we sow. The point is this, chapter 9, verse 6, "Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully." Hang on a minute, you just said that what we gave had got nothing to do with how much we got back. Health, wealth, prosperity teaching says you give lots to God, God will give lots back to you. What Paul is saying is, you give lots to God, you will know spiritual blessings. So if you give £10,000, it doesn't mean that the next day a cheque for £20,000 is going to arrive. you give £10,000, you see what can be done with that in terms of spreading the gospel, seeing people converted. What joy will fill your heart when you see the consequences of giving? And it's those sort of blessings that we should be looking for. Not material blessings. Let's look for spiritual blessings. God will supply all our needs. There's that well-known verse in Philippians 4 verse 19, but Paul says it here in chapter 9 as well. And what are we to give for? We're to give for gospel work, for Christian work, not general charity. Yes, there are dreadful things going on in the world. The world, amazingly, has compassion upon such people and gives to such work. Does the world give to missionary work? No. Does the world give to church work? No. Well, if the world doesn't do it, who's going to do it? And so we should be careful in where we put our money. We should be thinking in terms of the gospel and its spread. And yes, let us support relief agencies, but let them be Christian relief agencies. Because we know then the love of Christ will be communicated. So we support the Good News Hospital in Madagascar because we know not only are the people there healing the sick, but we know also that they are preaching the gospel to those that they encounter. Because you can heal the sick, but what good is that going to do them on the day of judgment? None at all. So yes, heal the sick out of compassion for them. But if you have real compassion, you also have to deal with their spiritual health as well. So support for that sort of work, for the ministry, for gospel preaching, for the spread of the gospel, and for the godly poor. Those who are members of churches and yet they have nothing. And they wonder where on earth their next meal is going to come from. So we read in 1 Timothy about enrolling widows. That is, widows who are real widows. That is, those who have no means of support. These are the people who should be supported. But if it's a young widow, well, she can go out and get married. And then she'll be supported. Not a burden on the church. Paul's very practical. Only those who are in real, genuine need. And so therefore we need wisdom in knowing how to spend the money that God has given us. Now in giving, our left hand should not know what our right hand is doing. So we should give in secret, not publicly. Because there is always the danger that we allow someone to see us putting in those big wad of £100 notes, and there might be a tendency to just flap them around a bit so people notice, turn it round so that you see how much I'm putting in. Of course, what you can imagine some people doing is they get a big wad of paper and put one note at one end and one note on the other end, and it looks as if it's a lot of money, but in fact it's not. No, we're not to do that. You do it secretly. You don't do it with others watching. We do it so it's between us and God. And we're to give according to our means. So that means that if you're on the bread line, if you have great difficulty in making ends meet, then perhaps you shouldn't give anything at all. But if you're William R. Gates III, the richest man in the world, his wealth goes up and down depending on the share price of his company, but it's probably around about $50 billion at the moment, I think he can afford to put in more than 10% of his annual income. Remember, his wealth is not the same as his income. But he gets paid roughly about $50 million a year out of the company. If he gave 10%, that's $5 million. Wonderful! Yeah, but he could afford to put in double that, triple that, quite easily. And he wouldn't feel any problem at all. So the wealthier a person is, the more they can give. And so therefore they can relieve the suffering. They can help spread the gospel more than so many others. But they're not to do it in a flamboyant manner and say, hey, look, I'm giving this big check. No, just give it. And do it as anonymously as it's possible to. So we're to be sacrificial in giving, like the widow in Luke 21. And it shouldn't be a problem for us, because Paul tells Timothy about the dangers of being a lover of money. We are not to love money, because the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. So we need to beware. Is our concern a concern for God's glory or for our own comfort? If we have wrong thinking on this, then we might live well in the eyes of the world, but will we be living well in the eyes of God? Neither should we think that by giving money we are earning brownie points with God. God's not interested from that point of view in our money. He is interested in us giving ourselves to Him, in surrendering our lives to Christ, and recognizing salvation's free. He gives it freely, and He can't be bought, because everything in the world is His anyway. So we cannot buy anything from God. So therefore, let us take heed to these things. Let us seek to be like the widow. Let's seek to live our lives in sacrificially giving to the work of God, and demonstrating by the way in which we give our love and our gratitude to God for what He has done. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift, which will lead us on suitably to the Lord's Supper, which we will be remembering in a moment.